The way that I'd like to approach this, I really want to get into the details of the text and look at things that we don't usually pay attention to as we read the Megillah every single year. We read it quickly in approximately like 30 to 40 minutes tops, you know, and hopefully we pay attention to it and we're listening, but there are so many nuances and so many details that 99% of people, I would argue 99% of people miss, overlook, or misconstrue, or don't pick up on, because they're, you know, they hear it one time, and not to say it goes in one ear and out the other. I think everybody remembers the basic storyline of the Megillah, the basic storyline of Haman and Esther, but certainly not with the level of attention and detail that it actually provides you, you know, because really it's a text to be learned, and there's so much that can be extracted from the text. I'm going to ask you a trivia question, and don't yell out the answer if you know, okay? But it's a trivia question just to illustrate to you how much or how little people know about the story of the Megillah just from having heard it again and again. And I'm just going to warn you that I've never had anybody answer this question correctly. So if you get it wrong, that means you're together with 99% of people, and don't feel bad, okay? And you don't have to shout out your answer, but how long, over how long of a period did the events recounted in the story of the Megillah take place? You know, like when you watch a movie, sometimes a movie can actually be like 20 years of time or 50 years of time. Sometimes it's showing you what happened in a week, you know, or 2 weeks. Let's say the story of Egypt, of Mitzrayim, Exodus, it's not counting the whole long period of the enslavement, but the end part is maybe about, you know, it's like 18 months of time, right? So approximately. So we have a sense of the time. How long from the beginning of the Megillah to the end of the Megillah, how much of a period of time would you say that is? Is it 50 years? Is it 40 to 50 years? Is it 1 year? Is it 10 years? Is it 25 years? Well, what is it? Who wants to take a guess? You say 2 to 3 years. Okay, first guess. What do you say? It'll be like The Price is Right. Do you remember The Price is Right? Whoever's closest, they win. You say a year and a half? Yeah, without going over? I don't know if anybody remembers that show. That's from a long time ago. Yeah, The Price is Right. Whoever gets closest to the price, they're the one that wins. Are they're not allowed to go over? Was that the rule? I didn't remember that. Okay, so I obviously didn't pay that much attention. Okay, so we have 1.5 years, you said, and you said 2 to 3 years. Any other guesses before we... 6 months?
It's a long time.
You say a long time? What does a long time mean? 30 years, 40 years?
No, I don't remember.
You don't remember, okay.
5 years.
You say 5 years? Okay, so far nobody's right. Any other guesses?
4 years?
4 years? You're going the wrong direction. Got to go up. Okay, the Megillah takes place over a period of 9 to 10 years, believe it or not, from the opening story of Achashverosh's huge party, which is how this is the opening scene of the Megillah, is the huge party of Achashverosh, where we know what happens to Vashti and everything. That is in the 3rd year of the reign of Achashverosh. It says in the 3rd year.
Party?
It was a 1 year party. It was, yeah, a 6 month party, yeah. That was a 187 days party. So a little bit more than a half a year.
So then the decree was he's going to prolong it for a year to make them suffer?
No. The party is separate. The party is just where Vashti dies. That's the only importance of the party. But that happened in the 3rd year of his reign. I'm just giving you a basic timeline. So in the 3rd year of his reign is when the party happened and Vashti was killed. Esther was chosen. When we think of the story, we think of like, oh, Vashti was killed. Esther was installed as the queen within, you know, a matter of months. No, it was 4 years later. It was in the 7th year of Achashverosh that Esther was made the queen. And when was Haman's decree? It wasn't 5 minutes after Esther became queen. It was in the 12th year of Achashverosh's reign. Now you'll say, wow, how do you know all these details? Were you there? Did you do, you know, it's actually all written in the Megillah. We just never pay attention to those little details. It says, in the 3rd year, in the 7th year, in the 12th year of the reign of Achashverosh, Haman made his lottery to determine when to kill the Jews. And it was supposed to happen in the following year, which I guess would have made it 13 years. But he never got, I mean, we do get to that point. We get to the point of the 13th year, which is, you know, I guess would make the Megillah stretch to 10 years full.
So
A full 10 years in the end.
Didn't Ahasuerus sell out the Jews to Haman for 10,000 talents of silver right in that party?
No, he didn't. That's why people get a lot of the details mixed up. That's why this is such an important class to do. Okay? Now, we're going to divide these. We're going to have three classes. And I want each class to be focused on a specific thing so that we keep the order and we keep everything organized in our mind. Okay? The first night, tonight, we're really going to talk about the first part of the story, which I would say is the what can we see about Ahasuerus to understand Ahasuerus's character, the rise, the entry of Esther and the rise of Haman up to the decree of Haman. That's really the first segment of the story. The second segment of the story, if you're thinking about it in terms of like, you know, writing a book report, right? The first part of the plot is the problem, which is Haman rising up and making the decree against the Jews. The second one is Esther getting involved, intervening, and how she manages to bring a positive resolution to the situation. And the third part is really the conclusion, is how the Jews end up standing up for themselves and the celebration of Purim. These are really three different distinct things. The first three or four chapters of the Megillah deal with just the rise of Haman and the decree of Haman. Chapters, you know, 4 through 7 or 4 through 6 or 7 deal with Esther's intervention and, you know, and the immediate aftermath. And then there's like three chapters at the end of the Megillah that just talk about the Jews standing up for themselves in the celebration of Purim. It's really kind of, you know, it's spread out. You almost feel like the story is over in chapter 6 or 7 because the Jews are saved, but not really. It's not over yet. So we're going to see how all this unfolds. Now, why do I particularly love the book of Esther? It's probably one of my favorite books to study because it's a very human book. There's no mention of God's name anywhere in the Megillah. And the characters in the Megillah are very complex psychological portraits. They're not simple characters. They're characters that you can really get to know them, get to understand them, and grasp their motivation. So from a psychological perspective, from looking at it from a psychologist's point of view, it's just a fascinating book because you see the different characters and their motivations and their interests and sort of you can put them all in a category and they become in your mind a kind of like example of a certain type of a person that you can identify in your own life, a person just like that probably, you know, once you understand the kind of person that they really are. And then just seeing how really the idea of the Megillah, and I think we'll get to more of this towards the end of the story. I don't want to say it now, but the idea that the Megillah is illustrating to us how God's saving of the Jewish people doesn't have to come through a supernatural means. God's saving of the Jewish people comes when good people do the right thing or use their intelligence and use wisdom to solve problems in a way that is wise and guided by Hashem, but not with Hashem's explicit direct intervention. That's really what the story is about. It's about two people who are inspired with the wisdom of Judaism guides them in the way that they do things, but it's not not God's hand like intervening in a direct way. So we're going to see that and that pattern. I think I'm going to come back to that more towards the end of the Megillah. I want to let the Megillah speak for itself. So let's take a look at the very beginning on 1252. Okay, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was Ahasuerus who ruled from Hodu to Kush, which is generally translated as from India to Ethiopia. Sheva v'esumumea medina, 127 provinces. And in those days, he sat on the throne of his kingdom in Shushan, the capital. And now we see in verse 3, Bishnat shalosh lemolcho. That's the first dating that we get in the Megillah. In the third year of his reign, it's on page 1252 in the back of this Chumash, in the third year of his reign, he made a party. This is verse number 3. If you're looking in the left column for the English and the right column for the Hebrew. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all of the officials and servants, the army of Persia and Media, the nobles and officials of the provinces being present. And as was pointed out before, this was quite a long party. This was a party of 180 days. The assumption being that people didn't actually stay for the entire time, but it was kind of like an open house thing, and people came when they could for a week or something like that, you know, over the course of the 6 months. Not that the same person, most people cannot take 180 days to go party somewhere, even if they are very important people. They can't really do that. They have a job, they have whatever, they were rulers of different nobles and officials, and obviously that would destroy the, you know, any functioning government if all the nobles and officials went somewhere for a six-month party. So, meaning that they went, it was open for 6 months. Now, the notice that it was in the third year of his reign. that he had this big party. What does that suggest to us? Does it suggest to us anything about what might have been happening in the kingdom of Ahasuerus? Just right off the surface, does it suggest anything to us? Yeah. That's why he's having the party.
Yeah.
Right, but that suggests that maybe before that it wasn't so golden, right? He was waiting for an opportunity to do it. He was in power already for 3 years. Usually you have a coronation party, like something like that, like right away, you know? But he didn't, because seemingly the beginning of his reign was not so, it was a little bit rocky. And therefore he waited for a moment to where things became stable, that he could have this big party and invite everybody and all that. So the implication is that, is Ahasuerus, in other words, is Ahasuerus secure, as we would say in today's terms, is he secure in his manhood? And I think the answer is not so much, because you see that there was a lot of instability in the kingdom. And in the third year of his reign, when he finally felt that he had things under control, he has a huge party. But what is the purpose of the party? If you look at verse 4, what did he do during the party? He displayed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days. He's trying to send a message out to all these hotshots from his 127 provinces, because the first 180 days was really just a VIP party. It wasn't a party for everybody. It's a party for the top-notch people. He's trying to impress upon them what a big shot he is, how important he is, how powerful he is, how successful he is. And obviously that means you want to be with me, right? You want to work with me. You want to be with me because I'm the person who has all of this success, all this wealth, all of this honor. And then vicariously, you get to be a part of that when you are, you know, when you're part of my empire. He's selling himself to the people. All right, that suggests, and I would say, a little bit of a feeling of, he's trying very hard. Let's just put it that way. He's trying very hard to impress the people.
Insecure.
Yeah, he's a little bit insecure, okay? So, and I think that that's one of the themes that we see of a bunch of people in the Megillah, but Ahasuerus expresses it in one way and Haman expresses it in a different way. But it's interesting that the rabbis in all their commentaries talk about Ahasuerus as a person who wasn't actually born into the kingdom. He married in. They say that Vashti was actually of royal lineage, and Ahasuerus married her, and that's how he ascended to the throne. He was like the son-in-law of a previous king, not the son. So he didn't naturally come into this. And again, that makes you have what do we call that today? Imposter syndrome, right? A person feels like, I don't really belong here. I'm not really supposed to be here. And maybe people are going to see through me and realize that I don't really belong here. You know, there's like all these worries and all these anxieties that maybe Ahasuerus has, that he is trying to make it very clear what a big deal he is to everyone. And even to the point, it says that, you know, anybody who wanted to drink, he had, aside from all the decoration that's described, and the golden goblets, and they were all different, such a variety of different eating utensils and things like that, and finery, I guess you would call it, royal wine in abundance according to the bounty of the king. It even says that every person, nobody would be coerced to drink. Everybody was given, you know, their personal drink order. It was very personalized. He had the personal touch. All of this is very much about, it's like when you go to Kolbe and they're always like, this is only for you. Wow. Can't believe only for me. I get all these extra salads. Every single person comes and gets them. No, it's only for you. Wow. I love Pejman, and I'm always going to come here because he gives me, right? That's what he's been there for, like, forever, right? So, like, I think when I was 10 years old, he was saying, this is only for you. I remember. And so that's the secret of a good business. You know, he really makes you feel that you are special, makes you feel that you're important. And so this impact that Ahasuerus is trying to create, this effect, right? The Kolbe effect, very appropriate. It's in Persia also, right? So he's giving people that feeling of being special, being unique, being a real VIP, getting the VIP treatment, the red carpet treatment, whatever you would call it, is what he's going for. Now, at this point, Ahasuerus, you can get also a sense of what kind of a king Ahasuerus is. Because there are different kinds of kings. There are different kinds of important people. There are different kinds of successful people. There are people who like honor and glory, and there are people who like to party. Right? There are people who are more attuned to the indulgence. They want to enjoy, like as Mel Brooks said in The History of the World, it's good to be the king. That type of an attitude. For those, that's an old movie. Maybe it's an ancient movie, but you probably saw it. You're my age around, right? Or you're a little younger than me. No, you, Josh. Are you younger than me?
Yeah.
No, you.
You're a little younger than me.
Okay. Yeah, but our fathers would be from the same era, so I figured they would watch the same movies. Anyway, these are the movies that my dad watched when I was a kid, so I ended up having to watch them too. Anyway, so when you're a king that is mainly in it for the enjoyment of the good life, so to speak, right? The enjoyment of the pleasures of that being a king affords you, being a powerful person affords you. You're not really interested in the glory. You don't get the sense that Ahasuerus is especially interested in glory. He likes to party. He likes to drink. He doesn't like to think too much. One of the funny things about Ahasuerus is he never hears a suggestion, and you can test this out throughout the entire Megillah if you read it closely. Ahasuerus never hears a suggestion he doesn't like. Anybody recommends anything to him, he's like, that sounds great. He never wants to think too much. The first cogent suggestion that he hears, coherent suggestion, whatever, he's willing to take it. As long as he can delegate the decision-making to somebody else and he can go back to the party, he doesn't want to have to deal with it any further than that. That's enough. And so Ahasuerus is, and that's one of the things that the rabbis say about Ahasuerus is very interesting, but I guess we'll chart his development through the course of the story. As I said, I really want to divide the story into the three parts, but everyone knows at the end that Ahasuerus becomes a friend of the Jews. The question is, did Ahasuerus change? So the rabbis emphasize in the first sentence of the Megillah, it was in the days of Ahasuerus. Who Ahasuerus? He is Ahasuerus. Why do they emphasize that? Why does the Megillah emphasize that? The rabbis say to tell you, he never changed. He was the same from beginning to end. It's not like he changed. He just, a person who's mainly interested in their own personal satisfaction, they're just looking for who will be the best helper for me to get that. You know, who's going to best facilitate me pursuing my self-indulgence? Oh, I thought it was Haman, but that didn't work out. So now I think it's Mordechai. But really, it's still self-interest. It's still self-absorption. In other words, Ahasuerus is a type of a wicked person that you would call a decadent person, would be the right word in English to use, okay? He's a person who is indifferent to, let's say, injustice and indifferent to suffering and indifferent to all that because he's only concerned with his own pleasure. Not because he's necessarily a mean guy. Ahasuerus might not be a mean guy. He might be a very gregarious and friendly guy. He might love to schmooze and tell good jokes and he's a party, you know, he's a party guy. He would probably be the life of the party. Very friendly. He's not mean. He's just indifferent when you're that kind of person. And that's why they always say decadent societies end up falling, you know. It's one of the things everyone always talks about America. Oh, yeah. People always talk about that in America, that people get so
comfortable.
Right, so comfortable, so self-indulgent, so not, vigilant about what the problems of society are that it ends up crumbling underneath them without them realizing it because they're just having a great time. And so that's one of the dangers of any decadent society. And the problems they start having are not real problems. Like instead of actually addressing the problems of society, they're worried about people's pronouns and stuff like that or whatever. Things that are not really essential to the functioning of society, that's what ends up occupying their energy. I'm not trying to get political. I'm saying like you can, it's called the first world problems. You know, it's like these are presupposing that everything else is okay and functioning so well in our society that this is what we really need to invest energy in talking about. You know, and that's the problem. So in any case, Ahasuerus is a person who's involved in having a great time. But there's only one problem, which is who else is having a great time? His wife Vashti. His wife Vashti is also having a party. She's having a ladies' party. And after the 180-day party of Ahasuerus, which was for VIPs only, right? You had the VIP card to get in. He had an open party for the people of Shushan for 7 additional days where anybody could come. You didn't have to be a highfalutin person. You didn't have to be one of the VIPs or an official or a noble. Anybody could come, and he opened the palace for a party for everybody for 7 days. And he reached the last day of the party. He was so close to making it to the end of his 187-day party. He could have closed it out and had, you know, it would have been a party for the, you know, that would have gone down in history. But, well, it did, but not for that reason. Because on the very last day, Vashti is having her own party, and Ahasuerus makes a request. He wants her to come and make an appearance at his party. Now, obviously, putting aside all of the various stories that we learn as children and midrashim and legends about what happened to Vashti, why she didn't want to come to the party, just on a very, very simple, straightforward level, would any woman who is a dignified woman, who is a queen, want to be paraded as an object in front of a bunch of drunk people from the town that were there for 7 days partying with the king? Probably not, right? He's basically asking her to be like a trophy that he's going to show off to these guys who've been drinking and partying, and they're going to leer at her, and it's going to be very uncomfortable, and definitely not very respectful of her regal status. So she's not going to like that very much, and so she refuses to come. That's just the pshat of it. There's other midrashim, oh, she had this reason or that reason for not coming, but I think the simple reason is obvious. Who would want to come and participate in that when you're being treated in such a disrespectful way? So now Ahasuerus has a dilemma for the first time. And Ahasuerus does not like dilemmas. He likes dilemmas to be resolved as soon as possible, because when you have a dilemma, you can't party. You know, and because you're too worried and you're too concerned. And so he doesn't want to stay in the state of tension. He needs to resolve the dilemma right away. The problem is he's trying to project this very powerful, very impressive, very wealthy, very opulent, very I'm the top dog type of an image to all of his subjects, both the important subjects and the ordinary subjects. And now his own wife, who you would think would be the one who would be, if he's really that great, right? If he's really that amazing, then certainly his own wife would realize that and would be, you know, very willing to participate in whatever he asked her to do. She is pulling the mask off of him, so to speak, showing that really, you know, he can't even direct the behavior of his own wife. That's how he's going to be seen. Okay, he's going to be seen as ineffectual. Maybe his imposter syndrome is rising to the surface, like, oh, I'm not really that powerful. My wife is actually the powerful one. I'm not really that powerful. I'm not really that impressive. Everyone's going to see it now. What am I going to do? He's very, very angry about that, and he doesn't know what to do. And what does Ahasuerus, who never makes an actual decision in the entire Megillah, like any good leader, yeah, never makes any decisions, always delegates the decision to his advisors. He asks his advisors, what should I do? And what we're going to see here is a prototype for, and this is good for you, you can take this to the board meetings and use this, a prototype for how to make decisions that have an objective that you can't really directly admit is true, but you can clothe it in an objective that sounds very noble and very very respectable. So what this person, Memuchan, says, this person, Memuchan, offers a solution to the problem. Because what's the problem here? Let's get into the head of Ahasuerus for a second. Has anybody here ever taught kids and they misbehave? Yeah. And they misbehave and you don't know what to do, because if you take a very harsh response, then you feel like, you know, I'm making such a, I look weak that I'm taking such a harsh response to such a, you know, to this kid. It actually makes you feel weak. It makes you feel out of control that you have to respond in such an overwhelming way to a child misbehaving. On the other hand, if you do nothing, the child's going to keep testing and ruin the whole class. So what do you do? You're stuck either way. There's no easy solution. So what do you do? And that's exactly what Ahasuerus is thinking. Meaning, if I take a very drastic decision here and I do something really to show Vashti what's what, and, you know, I put her in her place, it might feel good in the moment, but actually I look pretty pathetic. It's like I had to have a nuclear response to my wife's, you know, not wanting to come to a party. On the other hand, if I do nothing, I'm also going to look pretty pathetic because I told my wife to do something and she openly refused to do it in front of everyone, and I'm the king. How dare she do that? So either way, I'm going to come out looking weak. You come out looking weak if you have a response that's over the top to a small offense, right? We imagine somebody gets offended by a small remark somebody makes and they go ballistic over it. They actually look pathetic. On the other hand, if you let it go, it could fester and lead to even worse things. So what do I do? Either way, I'm going to look like a loser. Either way, I'm going to look weak in the eyes of the people, either because I overreact or I don't react and I let it go. Either way, I look weak. So what do I do? So Memuchan has really a great solution. And this is in verse number 16. Memuchan declared before the king and the officials, it is not only the king whom Vashti, the queen, has wronged, but also all the officials and all the people and all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Meaning, what is the problem here? The problem is you're thinking small. You're thinking this is about Vashti and Ahasuerus. It's not about Vashti and Ahasuerus. This is a matter of principle. This is a matter of principle. This is endangering the domestic tranquility of the entire kingdom. Because, for the deed of the queen will come to the attention of all women, making their husbands contemptible in their eyes by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought before him, but she did not come. And this day the princesses of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's deed, will cite it to all the king's officials, and there will be much contempt and wrath. In other words, all the women are going to say, hey, if Vashti doesn't have to listen to her husband and he's the king, then I definitely don't have to listen to you. And then imagine, this was back in the day when wives listened to husbands. This was a long time ago. Right, so back then it was like scandalous, the idea that the wife would not listen to the husband. It's going to undermine the tranquility and the peace of every home. Shalom Bayit is going to be lost. I mean, they didn't talk about Shalom Bayit in Persia, I mean, whatever, you know, but the idea of, this wasn't for the Jews specifically, but meaning, what's Memuchan's idea? Take it out of the realm of the personal. If you take it out of the realm of the personal and it becomes a matter of official state business, Vashti, what she's doing here, I'm not reacting to Vashti because I'm personally offended or I'm personally weak or she personally insulted me. No, I'm not so small as to care about that. But what I care about is the stability and the future of my kingdom and my citizens and my subjects. And therefore, I need to do something with Vashti to make an example of her so that what she did doesn't affect, harm my citizens in such a terrible way and destroy everyone's home life. And there'll be tons of divorces, domestic violence, God knows what else. Okay, so what basically Memuchan does, it's really a good move, you know, politically. He's giving him a political solution. It's like people say this all the time. It's a matter of principle. I'm not suing him because I want the money. It's a matter of principle. I'm not complaining to the manager in the restaurant because I didn't like the food. It's a matter of principle. They have to do good service for the customers. In general, I'm doing it for their own good. It's not actually for me at all. I didn't want them to comp me. I didn't want them to. No, I only did it for the sake of the good of all customers of all restaurants, because people need to know that, you know, service has to be proper and right, and that's how they're going to learn. I'm going to teach them. That's exactly the kind of, you hear people say stuff like that all the time, right?
Nobody's but, above the law.
Right, yeah, nobody's above the law. It's a matter of principle. I'm doing it for, you know, to make a point. I'm not doing it for. People say that all the time. Occasionally, it might be true. I'm not saying it's never true. I don't want to say that there's nobody who ever does anything for principle. There are people who do, and there are people who do things for a greater cause or to, you know, to send a message that's important. There are, but many people, in order to make themselves feel better or look better when they're actually doing something petty, will clothe it in a kind of a noble garb that it's really for the sake of a greater good. So that's exactly what Memuchan is telling Ahasuerus. And if you think about it, it's an ingenious solution to an otherwise insoluble problem that Ahasuerus had in this case. And of course, immediately he loves the idea and he immediately implements the idea because and sends out this decree to everyone, and they send out to every single person that every man should be the ruler in his home. Right? So the decree was in the end that in verse 19, if the king finds it good, then a word of the king should go out, I mean, a decree of the king should go out that can't be revoked, of course, because we know that Vashti will never again appear before Ahasuerus, and the king will confer her royal estate upon somebody else. By the way, it never says she was killed. It just says she was never allowed to appear before him again. Maybe she was banished. It's not so clear. And then the decree finally was that, and then when the king's decree, which he shall proclaim, shall be resounded throughout all his kingdom, all the wives will show respect to their husbands, great and small alike. And they send out a decree that all wives must respect their husbands and speak the language of their husbands and all that. Okay. So in other words, basically the reframing that happens here is a creative solution to an intractable problem. Did you have a question that you wanted to say? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the advisors knew he was like
this. 100%, yeah. I mean, I think it's connected, but probably it's somewhat connected. I mean, I think that he wants to keep this delicate balance of staying in control and staying in charge to allow himself. So even when Haman, for example, approaches Ahasuerus to try to kill the Jews, what's his angle? His angle is, oh, there's a group of people that they don't follow the laws of the king and they don't listen to the king, they don't respect the king. There's going to be instability in the kingdom. There's going to be this, there's going to be that. And therefore, you should really... get rid of them. And it says there that the king's like, no problem. You don't even have to pay for it. I'll pay for it. And then it says, V'amelech v'aman yashvu lishtot. And then they just had another drink. They're like, I'll drink to that great idea. He didn't ask, who are they? What is the story? What exactly are they doing? He didn't ask anything. He didn't care. The point is that Ahasuerus is a wicked person, of a decadent wicked person. He's indifferent. He doesn't care because he's enjoying himself so much. He doesn't need to care. He's self-absorbed, okay, in his own pleasure. So that's Ahasuerus' first thing. Now, you'll notice something that I kind of, in a way, hinted to now, alluded to already, that the rabbis say something about this guy Memuchan, and it connects to your question also about his understanding of Ahasuerus. Because what do the rabbis say about Memuchan? So what do they say about Memuchan? Memuchan ze Haman. It was actually Haman. Haman was a royal name that he took when he took a higher position. Memuchan was actually Haman. Now, that's not the literal reading of the text. It seems like two different people. But whenever the rabbis tell you that two characters are really the same when they seem to be different, they're trying to tell you there's a commonality between the characters, whether they were historically the same person or two different people that just had a very similar MO. Now, when the rabbis do that, whenever the rabbis say, oh, this person A was really the same as person B, you have to immediately look at those two people and try to think, what is the commonality they're pointing out that you might miss? Think about what Haman's situation was that he found himself in. He was personally offended by Mordechai not bowing to him. Too offended by it. But it was like embarrassing to him and petty. And it seemed like a disgrace. It says, "Vayivez beinav lishloach yad b'Mordechai levado." It was like an embarrassment and a disgrace to kill Mordechai when everyone else is bowing to you. You can't tolerate that one guy, one nobody is not bowing to you. It was bothering him psychologically so much, but he couldn't do anything about it. So what does he do? He decides to make it a matter of principle. The same exact thing. He says, this isn't about me and my personal beef with Mordechai. Of course not. What kind of a small-minded, petty guy do you think I am? No, it's for the sake of the kingdom, because Mordechai is just a representative of a certain group called the Jews. They don't follow the laws of the king. They don't respect the king. They don't respect the rules of our kingdom. They follow their own rules and their own traditions. They're scattered throughout the kingdom. They give no benefit to the kingdom at all, and we really should get rid of them. And of course, the king says that sounds like a great idea, because he's speaking these very broad generalities, making his own personal vendetta against Mordechai into some kind of a noble sacrifice for the sake of Persia, and he's willing to pay for it. Wow, Haman loves Persia so much that he's willing to pay. That's how you could tell he's actually not Persian, because he's willing to pay, right? He's not, because he's Amaleki. He's not a, he's Haman HaAgagi, right? So that's how you could tell. He is willing to pay, right? He actually is willing to pay for the sake of Persia to get rid of these people who are causing damage to Persian culture and society, not because of his own petty interest. So you see the same exact move that Memuchan tries to make, right? To reframe the conflict with Vashti and say that really it's not about your personal issue. It's really about the sake of Persia. That's exactly what Haman does with his own personal issue with Mordechai. He makes it into a matter of principle. And it makes himself look like, instead of look like a jerk or look like a pathetic loser, which maybe he actually is, he makes himself into some noble hero willing to pay from his own pocket for the sake of the kingdom. What an all-around great guy Haman is, okay? He turns the most petty thing into this great source of credit for himself. Pretty smart. Okay, so that's why the rabbis say, Memuchan is Haman, because they sound like they're doing exactly the same thing. They're spinning a situation from a personal issue, which again, shows you what kind of person is Haman. Is Haman a secure, confident person who commands respect by his presence and by his inner greatness of his character? No, obviously not, right? He's a very insecure guy. He's so insecure that of, let's say, hundreds of people bowing to him, one guy not following the rules is all he can think about. He says that I have everything, but anytime I see Mordechai, it's all worth nothing to me because of one person. Okay? So that's actually pretty insecure. That's pretty insecure. It's like a person who has, I don't know, nowadays people want likes on their social media accounts and stuff like that. Like one person makes a negative comment, that's all you can think about, a negative comment. You had 1,000 likes on your post, but the one person who put a dislike or said something negative, that's the one person that's bothering. That's the way Haman.
Yeah,
of course.
The way you're showing us, like, about Vashti, I always, as a kid growing up, it was like Vashti was painted as a bad guy in this story for some reason. I don't know why I'm thinking this way. Like, there's the pimple face episode, or but when you read the text, it's not.
It doesn't really say that.
Yeah. So, and then it makes me think about what you're talking about, how really Ahasuerus is a bad dude. He's not a really good guy. But we always focus on Haman being a bad guy in this. And we kind of like let Ahasuerus off the hook with what he did.
Right.
So it's like, is this really the right way to celebrate this story? We're the guy doesn't treat women well at all. He's a buffoon. He's always drunk. Mm. And the Jews happen to figure out a way to manipulate him. Not kill
exactly.
Jews. So like, why do we like give this story so much, so much honor when we, you know, always, when there's obviously bad things going on here that are not really.
Well, we're going to get more. I think we're going to get more into that as the story develops. Rather than give you a quick answer, I want to let that answer develop. But in terms of Haman versus Ahasuerus, I think, like, to me, they typify two kinds of a bad person, because there really are two kinds of bad person. You could say there's a bad person who's ambitious. Like, Haman is ambitious and vicious and vindictive and, you know, and wants to gain power at any expense and eliminate his enemies. And he has a large but very fragile ego. You know, that's one kind of a wicked person. Another kind of a wicked person is just self-absorbed and, you could say, narcissistic, but I wouldn't even go that far. Just completely involved in his own gratification, decadent personality like Ahasuerus. That's the kind of person you can manipulate, because whatever they see as offering them the easiest road to continuing their life of partying is the one that they're going to take. So it's a different kind of a wicked person. He doesn't really have like destructive impulses against the Jews. He just has his own self-interest in mind all the time, his own like physical enjoyments or pleasures or party. He's like a buffoon, like you said. I think it's a good word. He is a buffoon. He just wants to keep the party going. As soon as he's done discussing anything, it's back to the drinking. You know, even after the party, he's upset that now he realizes he doesn't have a wife and he doesn't know what to do. Okay, so these are the two men in the story that so far, both of them are insecure in a certain way. And in fact, the rabbis create or offer backstories to both of them. They talk about Ahasuerus worked for, you know, the previous king, married his daughter, really wasn't, you know, worthy of being a king. Haman also had a life as a barber. They talk about he was a barber. I don't know why that's so bad. I mean, nowadays barbers seem to make a lot of money, but he was just like an ordinary guy who kind of had a menial job, and then he became, somehow got into politics, which, you know, nowadays does happen. You have these random people that get into politics, and sometimes they're very successful. So he was able to climb. He was a social climber, a political climber, and he made it. But he also has a reason to feel insecure about his position and have to prove himself all the time and feel that anyone who challenges him is like pulling the rug out from under him. That's the way Haman is. Okay, so different interests, different agendas, but they're both bad, just in different ways. Like, you could probably hang out with Ahasuerus and have a good time. I wouldn't trust him, but you could probably have a good time. I'm not so sure you could have a good time with Haman. You know, he doesn't seem like a very, you know, like warm and cuddly type of guy. And usually when they portray him in the cartoons and stuff like that also, he's like more of a nasty guy, and Ahasuerus is more of a buffoon. There's actually a very, very good movie. There's a series of movies. I think they were made in the 90s, so they're a little bit old. But actually, the quality of the production is quite good. I think it was called like the Bible series or something like that. They did some for the non-Jewish ones and some for Jewish ones. And two of them that I've seen were really, really, really excellent. And one of them is Esther, actually. I can find the link. I think it's like free on YouTube. It's like up on YouTube and you can get it for free. It's so good. The acting is actually like top-notch acting and really gives you a feeling of what the story would have been like had you lived at the time. It's just really well done. I'll try to pull up the link and share it around because it's actually quite good. Like I watched it last year with my wife and a couple of my kids on like the Fast of Esther, and we went into Purim with such a different feeling. Like we actually connected to the story in such a different way because it was so vivid. But anyway, the next chapter is, of course, choosing a wife. And Ahasuerus realizes now he doesn't have a wife anymore. And, you know, you can't go through life without a wife, especially if you're a party animal, you have to have a wife. And so he doesn't know what to do. And his advisors give him actually a pretty harebrained idea. It's not actually a very good idea, but he likes it anyway. And their idea is that what you should do is you should collect all of the beautiful women from the entire kingdom. Okay, now according to the simple reading of the text, if you look it's really the beginning of chapter 2. It's on page 1253 here, and it's verse 3. He says, get a commissioner in all the provinces of the kingdom, and basically they're going to gather every beautiful young maiden to Shushan, the capital, to the harem, under the charge of Haggai, the king's chamberlain, guardian of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. So basically, he's going to have a date with every single one of the beautiful women in Shushan that's unmarried and pick the best one. But there's only one problem with the process, because a contest to choose the next queen might sound like a very, very desirable contest to participate in, because like when you buy a lottery ticket and you pay a dollar, and at worst, maybe you lost a dollar, but maybe you won, $500 million, so it's worth it. Right? So you could say, I'll go, and what's the worst thing that happens? I have a bad date with the king. Okay, it's a bad date with the king, and I lost, but, you know, no big deal. The only problem was that if you lost, you had to be a member of the harem permanently, which basically means you're a concubine of the king. You never get to leave. So if you win, you become the queen, and if you lose, you really lose. Like, you never get to, I mean, I guess you get to live in the palace, but you never get to have, like, your own life, your own family, your own husband. It's basically being like a slave to the king, essentially a concubine, forever. So the options are not so good. Like, most people would not really want to participate in a contest like that. And so the rabbis point out in the Midrash that whereas David HaMelech, when he wanted to choose a woman, chose, saying, I'm going to choose one woman, when he got old and they wanted to find him a companion because he was feeling cold at night and all that. One woman. And so everybody wanted that job. Everybody wanted the position. Because there was nothing to lose and everything to gain. You get to be the wife of the king. But here you have everything to lose. Because if you don't win, you're going to end up being the concubine of the king forever. Nobody really wants to be in the harem of the king as like a slave, basically, forever. So therefore, it's not so great. But they gathered all the women together. And they had a very, and this is where we first get introduced to Esther. Okay? And just to comment a little bit about her personality before we end, and then we're going to next time see what she does. Okay? But all of these, and this is where we see that, when did this happen? This happened, remember, the party was in the third year of his kingship, right? And all that's happening now goes on till the seventh year of his kingship, because Esther is chosen in the seventh year. So there's a four-year process of finding a new queen. And each of these women had a one-year spa treatment before they had their night with the king. 6 months in one kind of cosmetic thing, 6 months another type of a treatment for one night with the king. And whatever they wanted to bring along with them, they could get. If they wanted gourmet sabzi, if they wanted fesendrun, whatever they wanted, gundi, tadig, whatever they wanted, the food, whatever they wanted, the music, whatever they wanted, the decor, the outfit, everything they got to choose, their dream date to make it perfect for their opportunity to impress the king. And of course, once you're in it, you got to win it, because the alternative is being in the harem for the rest of your life. Everyone wants to win. That's the choice that they get. Okay? Esther comes along, and Esther is one of the women who is part of the, who is, now, what was the relationship between Esther and Mordechai? Does anybody know? Everybody gets this wrong also.
Is what, cousin, uncle, wife?
Some people say uncle. Everyone thinks that it's uncle, and some people say they were married.
She an
so she was an orphan, yes. That's correct. It says, she is Bat Dodo, the daughter of his uncle, which means they were cousins. Okay? That was the actual relationship. But obviously he's older than her because he's raising her. He was raising her. Now, Mordechai, Esther is a young woman. She gets taken as apparently a beautiful woman, gets taken as one of the contestants in the Miss Persia contest for the selection of Ahasuerus. But there's one thing that's really remarkable about Esther, which is, number one, she doesn't tell her background. She never tells who she is, meaning what is her ethnic background. She doesn't reveal it. Number two, she somehow, everybody loves her. So it says, for example, in verse 9, it says, the girl pleased him and obtained his kindness. It's talking about the chamberlain, the guy, Haggai, the person who's in charge of running the house, right? He hurriedly prepared everything for her cosmetics and her allowance of delicacies and the 7 special maids from the palace. He like almost elevated her to be queen before she was queen. He was already treating her like VIP treatment before she was even in, before she won. Okay, and she never told who she was, okay? And everyone, it says in verse 12, how each girl could choose whatever they wanted for their date. But Esther did not do that. Look in verse 15. Now, when the turn came for Esther, daughter of Avichail, uncle of Mordechai, to come to the king, she requested nothing beyond what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, guardian of the women, had advised. So notice a very different approach. That seems like an inconsequential detail, what she chose for her night with the king. But think about how not inconsequential it is. Because every other girl decided what they wanted for their night with the king. But what did Esther probably find out from Haggai? What the king actually likes. You know? It turns out he likes carafes. He doesn't even like fesendrun. Right? So she knew that that was it. So she, I'm thinking of all the foods that I like. You know? Anyway. She comes and arrives as the king's dream date, not her dream date. Okay, and that is a sign of the great wisdom of Esther already. Think about the fact that she doesn't reveal her identity. Everybody argues, well, why didn't she just say who she was? Why was she hiding it? Was she thinking maybe I'm going to have to save the Jewish people? Was she thinking this or was she thinking that? I don't think any of that is the pshat. My pshat, my simple reading of a text is this. The less people know about you, the more people will like you. Because they invent what they want to see. The minute you say, I am this, right? You see somebody who has like kind of olive colored skin. Every Persian thinks that they're Persian. Every Moroccan thinks they're Moroccan. Every Syrian thinks they're Syrian. Every Italian thinks they're Italian. Every Spanish person thinks they're Spanish. And everybody likes them and decides that they are part of their group. The minute they get up and say, I am This, oh, they lost all of those people who felt an identification with them based on their own imagination. The less you reveal of yourself, the less you show your hands, the more you have the, it's the same with anything, really. If you're hanging out with people who have different political views and you are very outspoken about your political views, there's always going to be people who disagree with you and alienate you and don't, you know, treat you differently. You don't say anything, everyone's going to assume you just agree with them, because everyone generally assumes that whatever they think about politics is right. And it's common sense. And so if they like you, they're going to assume that you agree with them. The minute you dispel that and you say something different, oh, so the point is, she's keeping it quiet, I think, because it gives her more currency as an attractive person. More, and in fact, that's what the Midrash sort of suggests. It says everyone said, oh, she's from our, every nation thought she was from one, she was one of them. So the Midrash says. Meaning that this was very smart. It was strategic. It was a tactic she used in order to gain an advantage in the contest, that she didn't reveal her identity. She didn't present herself as being part of a certain group that would limit her appeal. She didn't want to limit her appeal to anybody. Okay? So her attitude is, don't think about it from my perspective. If you want to succeed, you have to think about it from the other person's perspective. Think about the audience, how they'll respond if they know that I'm from this background or that background. Think about how the king is going to respond to our date. What will he like? What kind of clothes does he like? What kind of decor does he like? What kind of food does he like? What kind of music does he like? Right? If you've ever read the very famous book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, it's really old now, 120 years old, probably at least, something like that. You would have learned in that book by Dale Carnegie that one of the things he talks about is in job interviews, don't talk about why you want the job, because the boss doesn't really care why you want the job. You know, the boss cares, what can you do for me? You have to speak to them about what you can offer them. Not what they're going to give you. Walk in and say, I really need this job because I need this salary and I need this money and I need this. That's not the concern of the person hiring you. The concern of the person hiring you is, what can you do for them? So that's what Esther understood. As opposed to Haman and Achashverosh, who had their own, who were busy trying to pursue their own individual agendas and kind of cloak them in some kind of, you know, way that appeared noble. Esther is always never really shows her hand. She doesn't present what she wants. She doesn't present who she is. She's an observer of everybody else around her. She's rationally and intelligently observing and understanding everything that's going on around her. And that's why she's the person who, first of all, wins the contest because she's interested in what Achashverosh is actually looking for. Right? She's interested in it. She understands how people will view her, and she plays the role that she thinks that will alienate the fewest number of people. She's always thinking about the others and considering things from the perspective of the other rather than from her own perspective, and therefore she's able to succeed in working her way into the kingdom. Even the fact that we see that one of the first things she does is that Mordechai finds out that there's an assassination plot against the king. And what does Esther do? She tells the king in the name of Mordechai. Mordechai said this. Why? Because she understands how that can come in handy in the future, that there's a record that Mordechai helped the king. In other words, she's always thinking of a few steps ahead of everybody else.
So she played her cards perfectly.
Yeah. They did, but right, not in the, right. In the beginning.
Isn't it mostly physical? She must have been gorgeous.
I'm sure.
To be handpicked out of all these women.
Yeah, well, it says there were some circumstances that played in her favor too. Like, for example, the fact that it was in the winter time, so it was colder, and, you know, it's a time where you want physical warmth from another body. There's all kinds of things. But I think, yeah, she played her cards really well. She understood all the players and the motives of the people around her. And rather than try to fit things into the way she wanted them, she tried to understand what the expectations and the different, the different agendas that were at work in her environment, and to field them accordingly, basically. That's what she did, and fit into them accordingly. So we're going to see that that's really the same trick or the same toolbox that she won the contest with is how she's going to end up changing the future for the Jewish people when the decree happens. But essentially, the first half of this story, the first third of the story, is just being introduced to these characters, that we have Haman and Ahasuerus, who are each motivated by their own agendas. We have Esther, who is a very masterful student of other people's agendas and of other people's perspectives. We don't see so much that she's pursuing an agenda as much as that she understands that in order to succeed, you have to understand the other people and play the role accordingly, you know, and field what they're sending you accordingly and fit into it the way that you can when you're not the one in power. So you need to be able to understand the factors that are actually at play and adapt yourselves, to those factors. And that's what she does really masterfully in the beginning. And what we're going to see in next week is we already know the decree of Haman. We mentioned it before, but we'll see how Esther manages to turn everything around. But the key thing is just one last point. Why does Haman rise to power right after the assassination attempt against Ahasuerus? Many people don't notice that. Right after chapter 2, where at the end of chapter 2, after Esther's been installed as the queen, which is in the 7th year of the kingdom, of Ahasuerus' rule, 4 years after Vashti was removed, that's when there was an assassination attempt. And right after that, it says Ahasuerus promoted Haman because Ahasuerus realized I'm too vulnerable. I need a buffer zone. I need somebody else who's like the man out front. So you see, Haman's rising up is another way to protect Ahasuerus's high life. You know, he wants to keep living the good life. He doesn't want to have to deal with threats and assassination plots and all of this stuff. He doesn't want to be dealing with all this intrigue. So he puts Haman in there basically to be the person who is his second in command, but so he can absent himself from that kind of public role, because he gets nervous when he sees that people, you know, that there are people out there who want to kill him. But that shows you the kind of mentality. Ahasuerus doesn't try to become more, tyrannical and control things more. No, he recedes from it because he's not really interested in the power. He puts it in the hands of Haman. So we're going to see next time how Haman's plot evolves, how Esther turns things around in favor of the Jews, and how that all is really all the personalities that we've seen tonight. It's what happens in the next phase of the story is a function of those same characteristics that we see from the very beginning. Okay? Ezra Hashem next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.